Hey, kia ora koutou te whānau. How are you going? Hope you're doing really well. So today I have invited another really close friend of mine to be on the podcast. Now, I got to know Dan Bonato Sensei, who's our guest today, through the Bujin TV experience. And from there, kind of our friendship has grown kind of exponentially. He is, as I've often talked about, a fellow a nerd, and I'm hoping we're going to get into that. But also, there's a really interesting range of skills, and I would go so far as to call him I would say he has a plethora of skills. You see that? I like that word.
Plethora.
Of skills, in that he is well-versed in the Korean martial arts, and particularly Tang Sudo. He's a calligrapher, the martial calligrapher. He podcasts. He teaches martial arts, the well within martial arts. How would you call it? Framework, I guess. There's a whole bunch of things that he's involved in. We're going to get into it in the podcast. But Dan, thanks so much for taking time and putting up with me me pushing record, messing around with my audio. I really appreciate it. It's 10:30 at night there, so I know it's a real late one. So here, let's start with a good one.
Let's do it.
What, as a swordsman, as a martial artist, as a trainer of people, and as a student yourself, what's something you're working on in your training right this very minute?
Gosh. Breathing.
Wow. That's not what I had in mind. But go. Let's go. Breathing.
Constantly. Yeah, no. I'm one of those guys who is a firm believer in you get good at something by doing the basics over and 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 over again. You know, I have a student who's he's always really on point when he comes to me and tells me something. But at one point he comes to me and he says, you know, Sabanim. Sabanim in Korean means like instructor. So I'm sorry for using jargon that nobody understands. But he comes to me, he says, you know, I think I've figured this out. And I said, okay, what is the secret? He said, there is no secret. It's just doing the thing over and over again. Just get up and do the thing. And I was like, dude, I couldn't have put that better myself. So, you know, my student, Bernie, who if you've ever watched any of the Bujin TV stuff or watched any of my videos, he's the man that I'm throwing around a whole lot of the time. And we were talking earlier about, you know, being big people. So I'm 6 foot, you're 6'3". And he's like 5 foot. So like, you know, when I throw him around, it looks like I'm throwing around a child.
I've seen him. He was like, he's been in there from the kind of the earliest days, right? And you've done some really interesting concepts. The thing that always amazes, so Sabanim.
It's like Sabum Nim. Nim is like in Korean, it's like an honorary, like you would call somebody Nim, but you wouldn't call yourself Nim. So like I would never say, hi, my name is Dan Bernardo, Sabum Nim. Like that would be incredibly disrespectful. Like you wouldn't do that. So like, and you wouldn't even call yourself Sabum either. It's very similar. Yeah. Like you don't call yourself Sensei.
Yeah. Oh, I do. So like if I insist upon it. People who are not even in the martial arts, I like to, my ego needs regular shining and updating. And I'll say, look, I know you don't know me, but you know, I'm getting on the bus. Hand my bus pass and go, oh, that's Sensei, by the way. Yes, thank you.
Sensei,
go,
no, by the way.
Thank you, Sensei. But okay, so, you know, with that, with the content that you put out, one of the things that I have really always enjoyed was your, the connection of the dots, I guess, in terms of movement, but also something I'd love to get into is the Korean and the Japanese connection to karate. I know that in the past, you know, you kind of like to, you know, you're not out there waving flags, but certainly you're not backwards and coming forwards with your opinion. So I guess for me, I'm intrigued. What is it from your perspective? What is the connection between styles like Tang Sudo and karate?
So I don't want to get too deep into a historical lesson, but really the connection is the Japanese occupation of Korea. You know, for 40 years, Japan basically tried to make Korea a Japanese state, essentially. Same with Manchuria and a bunch of other places, and Okinawa, of course. During the occupation, a lot of Koreans went to study, you know, school, like, you know, university in Japan. And many of them also trained karate in Japan. So you have guys like Wanguk Lee, who trained at the Shotokan under Funakoshi. You have one of the two, Yong Kwe Byung. It might have been Yong Kwe Byung or Yun Byung In, one of the two. They trained in Shitoryu and Shudokan. Off the top of my head, I can't remember which one was which. Not enough coffee. But so you have these guys who, after the occupation lifted, they came back to Korea and they said, you know, we want to help strengthen our country and teach karate. One of the guys who's my lineage founder didn't train in Japan, but he trained with these guys in Korea, and he had a little bit of training in China because he worked for the Manchurian Railroad. And so he spent time in Chaoyongchuan in Manchuria at the time, and claimed that he trained in some Hantui, some springing step kung fu. And so in 1945, he started teaching a martial art that he called Hwasudo. He says in his 1958 book that he named this system Hwasudo because it was a combination of Tangsudo and the spirit of the Hwarang. So again, Tangsudo, and thank you for pronouncing it correctly. Most people here in the States say Tangsudo or Tangsudo or something like that. So it's nice when somebody says it correctly. But Tangsudo is literally the Korean pronunciation of the Chinese characters for the way of the Chinese hand, right? So how, you know, Todi in Uchinaguchi, that is a Chinese hand. So the Koreans pronounce those Chinese characters Tangsu, whereas karate, the empty hand, would be pronounced Gongsu, like with a K or a G, like Gong Su. So some in Korea did teach Gongsudo, and some taught what they called Tangsudo. Part of that really is what they were, what resources were available to them. So my lineage founder, Huang Yi, had access to karate books, Funakoshi's book and Mabuni's books, and probably more, but I know that I know for a fact he had access to Mabuni's book because he plagiarized it, errors and all, which has been a fun thing to find out. But but we know that he knew that early Funakoshi books used Chinese hand, so he adopted that term as well. But the Hwarang were like
I've heard them, you know, in that style Warang Do, which I've only seen in America. They talk about the Warang being sort of analogous to the samurai. Is that, how accurate would that be?
Not accurate at all. In reality, they were like, like I said, they were kind of Boy Scouts. They were young men who were groomed to become something of society. So either generals or artists or sometimes pretty boys or, you know, something. But, you know, there are stories of famous Hwarang that became, you know, war generals, military generals, war generals, that's not a thing, military generals. But beyond that, Korea was not a very militaristic country. So you can't compare the two. A lot of the comparison and such really came from a level of Korean culture after the Japanese occupation, really wanting to stand on their own and be something martial arts wise, unique and separate from their occupiers. But in reality, there's one martial art that is taught today, and you can still go and practice it today the same way that it was done and practiced before the occupation.
Hey, kia ora, guys. So I just wanted to take a moment and ask you a question. Do you, like me, struggle at times to find all those little things that sort of make promotions and the dojo feel just that little bit special? I always like to have the kind of certificates when I'm promoting people or grading and so on and so forth. They're just a little bit different, a little bit personalized, and kind of more a reflection of our dojo than my personal belief that there's a lot of templates out there that, whilst they may be correct, they're not probably as personalized as I like them. Well, today, if you use the coupon code Invisen, INVISEN, you can get 10% off custom scrolls, chops, certificates and logos, everything dojo needs. So the link is www.danbernardo.com, and I'll put a link in the description. Now, I asked him if I could do this because I really enjoy his work and I'm ordering some as well. So yeah, have a look at it, check it out, and you make that, make your dojo just that little more special and a little more customized with your very own customized calligraphy or certificate or logo, because he does great stuff. Anyway, enough of my yabba. Let's get back to the conversation.
And that's archery. That's it.
Oh. What is Korean archery? What is the Korean? I mean, I've seen, I think it's gamdo for swordsmanship. So what is the correct term for Korean archery?
It's gungsul.
Gungsul.
Gungsul. And it's a short Korean, short like kind of Mongolian recurve, but it's incredibly strong, incredibly accurate, up to like 300 yards. It's crazy. So they have like it's like a driving range, but for archery. And it's a thumb draw. It's a small. They're awesome. But like, Koreans have always been amazing archers. Just always have been. Like, if you go and you look at the Olympics, and you look at like when Korea first entered the Olympics in archery, especially the women's, and you look from then on, like they've won gold all the time. Like they're incredible. They're just amazing archers. But beyond that, everything else that you learn in Korea, like if you think of a Korean martial art, it is either a conglomeration or a compilation of something that came in from another culture, whether it was Chinese or Japanese, or it is a reconstruction. Trying to reconstruct some old martial art that kind of stopped being practiced for a considerable amount of time, so nobody knows really what it's about. But we have some texts, we have some pictures, we have some things. It's very similar to HEMA, historical European martial arts, where they take these manuals and they try to reconstruct them. The Koreans do a lot of that as well, but so much of it is Japanese. Kumdo is Japanese.
Kumdo. So. Mm. You know, it's interesting you bring that up too, bro, because one of the things which really impresses me, if you listen to what Dan's talking about, you know, there's anthropology, there's history, there's culture, there's a whole bunch of things. And I really love the way in which you've really made your business to become acquainted, not just with the technique, but something of the history and kind of the goal. I mean, you're a calligrapher. And I personally am a big fan of your martial calligraphy. If you get a chance, check it out on Instagram. And also Facebook's fantastic stuff. Great stuff for the dojo, for the doyoung, whatever you need. Fantastic stuff. Anyway, and also, you know, you're a swordsman, Dang Sudo, and you're also really involved in Chinese martial arts. So with the swordsmanship, we were talking, having a conversation the other day and doing like Katori Shinto Ryu. I mean, having that lineage and practicing something of that style was amazing. How do you take all these kind of, some would look at it and go, quite disparate sort of martial arts, you know, styles, each a study in its own, and kind of bring them together for your own study?
Oh, that's easy. Good martial is universal.
Oh man. Hey, I'm totally stealing that and gonna copyright that. Damn, it's
good
done.
Martial is universal. So I've been saying this for a really long time. And actually we've had two so far. We hold a good martial is universal workshop weekend where we get people from different styles together, and we look at how principles are taught and how they're taught differently within each system, and yet why they're the same, and how, you know, this is my biggest thing. If your martial art does something so unique and special that it doesn't exist in any other martial art, it's wrong. Because the only reason that you have something unique and special is because you're not actually using it against another person. So when I'm in isolation, I can move my body in any which way I like to, and it will look cool. But unless I'm actually trying to neutralize incoming force or strengthen outgoing force and actually seize and control another person, most of the time, it's all the same. How we get there might be different based on, you know, the tools that you use, the uniform that you wear, the terminology that you use, the titles that you use, what kind of floor you use. But the movements, right, the actual principle behind the techniques are going to be the same because we're all using the same tool. Now, if you change the tool, right, so let's say I put a sword in my hand. If you are using a tool that nobody else uses, then that's cool. But we don't see that either. The tools are all the same as well. If I have a single-edged curved sword and I'm a Japanese guy, it's going to look very, very similar to the single-edged curved sword in any other culture that has that same sword. If you use sword on horseback, it's going to look almost identical to everybody else that uses sword on horseback. If you use a long pole, it's going to look very similar to everybody else that used a long pole. There's really not a whole lot of disparity there. And
so what you're saying, so just to drill down on it a little bit, you know, the universal principles. I mean, how many ways can you swing a single-edged sword, right? How many ways can you punch a person, strike a person? Just the methodology and what sits behind it kind of is different. So let me ask you this, in terms of the mysticism that surrounds all these different approaches, if you had a platform or a billboard or some way to reach people and sort of say, give them a message about this stuff, what's sort of some of your pet peeves around the mysticism that kind of seems to permeate a lot of these arts?
I think when we talk about mysticism, a lot of it comes from a lack of understanding about the technique itself and the principles itself. You know, if I don't understand, you know, I don't, who said it? Was it Einstein who said it? If you can't explain it to a 5-year-old, you don't know it. Right?
I think it was season 3 of the original Star Trek, Mr. Spock on the bridge of the Enterprise, but maybe.
but to that regard, you know, if you go into the holodeck and, you know, and you are charged with teaching something to a 5-year-old and you can't do it, you don't understand it. And a lot of the times we, as as people, as human beings, we will rely on jargon and concepts to try to teach somebody something that we don't understand. And it will hide the fact that we don't understand it. When, you know, like for instance, you know, if I'm teaching Tai Chi Chuan and we're doing push hands, and somebody says, you know, well, what if I push on you like this? And I go, that's fine. Use single whip. And they go, what do you mean use single whip? Yeah. Whip the body. You know, use the single whip, you know. And then they go, oh, I never thought about it that way. It's like, it's because you're just doing the form, right? And this is where that if you do something in isolation, where nobody else is hitting you, nobody else is punching you, you will never, your body will never be able to learn how to deal with somebody pushing you. Because here's the thing. If you are working on a form solo, right? You're going through your form. What is the only external force working on your body?
I guess my answer to that would be the only external force, gravity.
The only thing pushing against you, gravity. Mm-hmm. And it's pushing you down. When somebody's punching you or grabbing you or kicking you or, you know, whatever, are they pushing you straight down?
Well, I mean, I feel put down when someone tries to punch me. I feel like there's something missing in me. I'm going, what? Was it something I said? Something I did? No, I take your point. It's interesting. I've actually never thought of that. Thought of it in that way.